This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I'm fed up with this sort of idea that sustainability doesn't have a political dimension. It most certainly does. And rather than just petitioning people in power to try and do something about the monetary system, we can continue to do that. But we can also just get on with experimenting with alternative currencies, not waiting for politicians with their lobbyists to come round to our ideas.
If you've heard about Bitcoin on the evening news or seen a headline about it, you might have been left with the impression that it's some sort of online scam or the next Dutch tulip bubble. But Bitcoin and other cryptographic currencies are very real. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Jem Bendel, a professor of sustainability leadership at the University of Cumbria, the world's first public university to accept Bitcoin for tuition payments. He explains how Bitcoin works and why he thinks it might help us move beyond the inadequacies and inequities of central bank-controlled currencies toward a sharing economy. Bitcoin has its critics, to be sure, but as New Yorker columnist James Surowiecki has so aptly put it, the value of currency is ultimately what someone will give you for it. Listen now as Jem Bendel discusses how Bitcoin is valued and the promise cryptographic currency holds for the sustainability movement. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Jem Bendel. Jem is a professor of sustainability leadership at the University of Cumbria in the UK. Jem, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. It's good to be on your show.
We've had some discussions in the past with one of your friends, Matthew Slater, about the global banking system. That was a couple of years ago before the rise of Bitcoin. First, for our listeners, what is Bitcoin?
Well, Bitcoin is becoming quite widely known now as an online currency, but what it really is a distributed global database. So this database that any internet-enabled device with the right software can talk to that and interface with that global database. One of the best ways I find in explaining Bitcoin is to say that if you or I log into our online bank account and we see, say that we've got $10,000 there, if we called up the bank and said, hey, that $10,000, can you email it to me? The person on the end of the line would think that we were crazy. Because the banks, they maintain that database of what we've got, and they manage the payments for us. So we're just seeing their electronic records. Now, with Bitcoin, what this does is it says, well, why don't we have a ledger or a global database that records what you've got, what I've got, and who we're paying? But we can do that without the banks. We can do that with our own internet-enabled devices running a software that maintains that global database. So Bitcoin is that kind of infrastructure. And then the Bitcoin unit itself is something that then is given to those computers that are processing the latest transactions fast enough. And so if you do that, it's called mining, because you then get 25 Bitcoin if you process a block of transactions and quicker than others and add it to that so-called blockchain, which is the global ledger. So when people talk about Bitcoin being, you know, over $1,000 at the moment, they're talking about that unit. And there's wild speculation on that unit, and so it goes up and down. But the actual infrastructure, this payment system worldwide, where anyone can transact without banks involved, is, I think, the real interesting innovation that is often not properly talked about.
So when somebody says that a bar in Spokane, Washington, is now accepting Bitcoins, and the Bitcoin market has fluctuated so wildly over the last, since its inception, how does a vendor translate the cost of a beer into a Bitcoin. If these are worth $1,000 each, then obviously that bar is doing pretty well by charging $1,000 for a beer.
There's a couple of things to note here. Bitcoin is divisible by many decimal points. So you can pay 0.00000001 of a Bitcoin for your beer in a bar. There's a number of ways as a merchant you could accept Bitcoin. You could accept it through opening a wallet, which basically means either you download a piece of software onto your computer or you use one of the online systems that hosts that for you in the cloud. And then you could give that wallet address to somebody who would then pay you in Bitcoin. The other option, which most merchants are using, is use a system like BitPay that actually does the conversion for you into your national currency. So you receive the national currency, and that means you're not exposed to currency risk, and it's all calculated for you so that you'll just name your price for, you know, your $2 to $5 for a beer, and the person paying that will use their Bitcoin wallet, but it'll all be transferred for them, and that exchange into dollars will be done for them. I think over time, as more and more people accept Bitcoin, and therefore people think, well, why don't we keep Bitcoin rather than just have it converted, because we can spend it on things, it will grow as a currency, and that's what people are predicting. But increasingly, the process of maintaining that global ledger is being done by extremely powerful computers using specialist ASIC chips. And so these are called miners. And they are increasingly charging transaction fees, whereby they'll prioritize your payment request if you agree to pay a transaction fee. And so if you want, say, if you're buying a beer and you want your payment to be processed very quickly, then you might add a transaction fee. And so whatever those have set at will actually influence the divisibility. And so that's emerged only in the last couple of months.
So in your view, Jim, what's the link between the shortcomings of our current global monetary system and our stewardship of the environment?
So Bitcoin is not the silver bullet. It's not the nirvana in terms of, you know, currency freedom at all. But I think what it's doing is it's opening people's eyes to the fact that currency is what we choose it to be. And we've sort of been deluded to think that not to even think about money, or to think that the way money is issued is somehow neutral, and it's not. It fundamentally shapes how we experience society and economy and what we think is possible. And it means that you and I think, maybe, I don't know, I used to think that, well, you know, we've got world hunger because people don't care enough. There's not enough money for it. And we can't save this particular species or this particular forest because there's no money for it. You begin to start to think, well, hold on, what does that really mean? And it means that people are being given power to achieve things by banks, and other people aren't. And that is the way money and credit is created. What I'm not saying that changing the monetary system will solve everything. It won't at all. And I'm not saying that we've got issues with human nature to deal with. But I think many of our problems are not helped or made worse by the current monetary system. And so that's why, if you're into sustainability and you believe that that the scale of the challenge is immense and urgent, and therefore we need to get together and be the change together, rather than just think that, you know, switching off lights and recycling at home, etc., is going to add up to the massive systemic change we need. If you think you have to do something more political, basically, I mean, what is this? I'm fed up with this sort of idea that sustainability doesn't have a political dimension. It most certainly does. And rather than just petitioning people in power to try and do something about the monetary system, we can continue to do that. But we can also just get on with experimenting with alternative currencies, not waiting for politicians with their lobbyists to come round to our ideas.
List some of the reasons why the current monetary system, the global banking system, needs to be fixed. What are your biggest beefs with it, Jim?
Sure. The way the banking system works at the moment is basically non-reserve banking. It means that the private banks, create our money when they issue loans, and that they do that charging interest on it, which means there's more debt in the world than money, which means we experience we experience wealth as scarce and something we must compete for, and it also means a transference of wealth to those that issue the currency. So we end up with the real economy struggling and the financial economy doing very well because of it's designed that way. And so we end up with mass inequality increasing pretty much year on year. That's actually a mathematical function of the way money is created. So if you care about inequality and reducing it, then you have to think about the monetary system. The other thing is, if you care about this sort of imperative of growth, the idea that we need to keep growing economically, then you need to look at the monetary system. Because when a debt gets paid back, that's that principle of the loan is extinguished, and that's our money supply. So unless you've got more and more loans, more this year than last year being issued, as the debts get paid off, the money supply shrinks. It's called recession or depression, and we know what that leads to. So our current monetary system means we can't have a steady state economy. So anyone who's into the whole post-growth thing and not talking about money just needs to read more. Another thing would be we find that if you're wanting to build a skyscraper or wanting to do all manner of quite destructive things, you're more likely to get a loan than if you're, say, wanting to set up a local social enterprise to provide for local needs. And we see that happening everywhere. Lending to the real economy for, you know, really useful stuff is going down. And so whereas, you know, highly speculative things are happening in financial markets. And that's, again, and it's just a natural outcome of the current monetary system, because a banker doing their job will look for the most collateral, the least transaction cost. So they won't want to make lots of tiny loans to social entrepreneurs. They have to try and understand the business model. They have to look for collateral, etc. So we haven't designed a monetary system that helps us to do stuff for each other in the way that people want. It's an economy where banks decide. So we need to moderate that. So that's another reason why.
But nowadays, the old man got all the money. And a young man ain't nothing in this world these days.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm joined by Jem Bendel. He's a professor of sustainability leadership at the University of Cumbria.
Baron Rothschild said in the 18th century, "Give me control over a nation's currency and I care not who makes its laws." So who is controlling Bitcoin? You said that mining is pretty much closed unless you have this access to super powerful computers. Does that mean that people who have access to super powerful computers are going to be the people who control most of this virtual currency? I'm always thinking about people in developing nations, how they can get involved in this. Will they be left behind if they don't have a computer or a supercomputer to be involved in the mining? And will they kind of get the dregs of this process?
That's a great question, Alex. And I share the concern about problems with the issuance of Bitcoin. If you adopted this early because you're a tech whiz, so you're generally male, you're generally young and Western, then you have access to a very cheap Bitcoin or free Bitcoin. And so, and now that's also made worse through the consolidation of mining power. So there's a number of things to say on that. First is that some forks of Bitcoin mean that more people can get involved. But still, these are currencies, cryptographic currencies are generally behaving like assets where people want the money rather than the money just being a means of exchange. And so these cryptographic currencies are only part of the solution. What we ultimately need to do is to move towards, back towards a system of the credit commons, whereby we ourselves have means to exchange with each other and issue credit to each other. And so I'm more interested ultimately in systems like that. And so Ripple seems quite interesting on that front. And the people who made a lot of money out of Bitcoin, Mt. Gox, have invested in Ripple. Because what Ripple does is uses that global database idea that's maintained on our computers. But what it does is it says that, well, you and I, Alex, know each other, but you don't know Dave, but I know Dave. Now, Dave wants you to post him something. Maybe it's a book you're going to sell him, but he wants to receive it from you before he sends you $20. And you think, well, I don't know if I trust Dave for that. But you trust me for $20, and I trust Dave for $20. And we've already entered that kind of level of trust into a software system. So basically, Dave goes down $20 to me, I go up $20 to him, at the same time going down $20 to you, and you send the book. The thing is, if you have thousands and thousands of people in such systems, ultimately none of those dollars have to change hands. All those positive and negative balances can be cancelled out. And this is a form of credit commons. It basically means that money is there in order for us to transact, and money in itself doesn't have a value. It's only a means of exchange. And what's happened with money issued by banks as debt with interest is that there's never enough of it to go around to pay our debts. So we treat it as scarce. So even though fiat money is a mere invention, accounting entry, we still behave as if it's a thing. And therefore, the amount of business we can do with each other and what we think we can afford to do for each other and for society is limited to this process of money creation. And that's a nonsense. We need to get away from that. So I think Bitcoin and cryptographic currencies only go so far. And ultimately, we'll need to move to these mutual credit and self-issued credit systems. The problem with Ripple is it's quite dependent on the people who set it up. And so I'm more interested, and I've worked for the last 4 years now, in much more grassroots alternatives with Community Forge and people like Matthew Slater. So where we create free open source software for communities to create their own currencies or to create their own trading platforms so they trade without money. And I think in the end, we're going to end up with a real multi-currency future where we'll have the cryptographic currencies, we'll have the local mutual credit systems, we'll have that also sometimes represented in physical notes, like some people we work with on the Bangla Pesa in Kenya. But we'll also have smartphones where we'll have a whole menu of our different currencies, and we can go into a shop and they'll say that they'll accept a whole bunch of different currencies, and we can make that transaction using our smartphone. I think the days of there just being the dollar and the days of the Fed and the banks deciding who gets it and how much and at what price are soon to be over. And I think we don't really fully realize what that's going to mean for the future power in society. And I actually think that's a good thing. I think we need to get involved and try and shape it for a sustainability outcome.
How would virtual currency overlap with a sharing economy?
Well, in many ways. So, for example, many of the local currencies, which are so-called mutual credit systems, whereby a bunch of people get together, they download software, they agree credit and debit limits, and they create their own unit. It might be an hour, or it might be an alternative local dollar, but it's issued between you purely at the moment of an exchange, to the extent that each and every one in that circle of users is going to trust each other. That is a sharing economy currency right there. What you're doing is you're sharing your time and your resources just because it's not renting or co-using, co-using a power tool rather than owning one. I mean, swapping like that may go on in those local currencies. Indeed, it does. But that's a currency and sharing economy application right there, fused together right from the start. But there are these platforms, Airbnb, Whipcar, etc., which are explicitly about and calling themselves sharing economy. Some of them are now looking at alternative currencies in a number of ways. One is the reputation metric. But another is, well, actually, it's organizations like Yodel have actually created their own currency now so that you can be encouraged to share, not only through your desire to share, to give, but also that can be rewarded through Yodel's own point system, which will then help you access goods and services through the Yodel network in future. For me, what that means is, as sharing economy platforms decide to do this, they need to understand monetary theory. They need to understand what is a good currency design and what isn't. And they need to think about how can our currency interface with other sharing economy platforms and the real world. We don't want multiple fiefdoms of so-called sharing platforms that only allowed you to share within their platform. We need to create a way that my Yodel points I can spend in another platform. She knows what you got from your matchy ball to the chicken in the pot, chicken in the pot, chicken in the pot, chicken down, downstairs.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Jem Bendel. He's a professor of sustainability leadership at the University of Cumbria in the UK. So a lot of recent media reports on Bitcoin, Jem, have focused on the speculation and the price spikes. And many journalists have latched on to the idea that Bitcoin is somehow the Dutch tulip bubble of the 21st century. How do you see it differently, and how can people get involved with Bitcoin without the risk of losing their shirts?
So there's a number of things to say about the speculative aspect to it. If it wasn't for the speculation, people wouldn't have heard of it. I mean, I heard of it in 2009, at the end of 2009, and because I work on complementary currencies. But so the speculative element to it means that a whole bunch of people, particularly people who thought I was lunatic in the sustainability profession, thinking I'm a lunatic because I'm talking about money and currency and credit and debt and that, they now are interested in Bitcoin. Why? I don't know. Because it's famous. Why? Because it went through $1,000. So the speculative element to it is actually quite educational, oddly enough. The paradox of it is it doesn't help it as a sort of a store of value or a day-to-day mean unit of exchange. I think there is always going to be a bubble aspect to it. What do I mean by that? Confidence in it is what creates its value. And I would not be surprised in the next 5 years we see Bitcoin go up to, say, $30,000, $40,000 each. And I wouldn't be surprised if it hit that and then went back down to $1,000. Because at the moment, it's not got enough users to be stable. It's not backed through, say, governments asking for tax in it, which is off the backstop for fiat currencies issued by the banking system at the moment. It means that you need some of it to pay your taxes. If a country says you can pay your taxes in Bitcoin, or more than that, even says you must pay some of your taxes in Bitcoin, we would think that would be tyranny, but we accept a government saying you must pay your taxes in dollars. That would create a backing, and it may help stabilize the price over time. So the speculative element to it, it means that I don't recommend people get into it unless they can risk losing that money. So I've got into it in a limited way back in March. I mean, you don't have to spend $1,000. You could buy, like, you know, $50 worth on one of the systems online if you wanted to just experiment and learn about it.
Let's say I go and I buy $50 worth. I Google Bitcoin and I just go to the first one that comes up and I put 50 PayPal dollars into it. And then what would I do with it? Would I be, if I, not just investing, let's say I wanted to go spend that, what could I do?
Well, you can, there's a wiki list somewhere which shows all the merchants, and I think they've even got a map now, so you could put in your zip code and you could find out who's accepting it. And as a bit of fun, you could go there with your smartphone and see if you can make a payment and see what you can buy in it. There's a funny little documentary of people who I think went around the world just using Bitcoin. So you could experiment to see how it is.
And then to the critics who say that Bitcoin isn't a currency.
Yep.
If you can go to bitcoinstore.com and buy a widescreen TV, just as somebody could go onto Amazon and buy that TV, how is that not a currency?
So Bitcoin is acting like an asset and it's being treated like an asset. For example, the Singapore Monetary Authority came out and said, we will treat Bitcoin like an asset. So you in terms of whether you store it and so on. So they're only interested in terms of when you end up interacting with the national currency with your Bitcoin. If someone says that Bitcoin is not a currency, I would ask them, what is currency?
The smartphone integration and the ease with how it can work with a mobile phone is one of the things that I think makes it very attractive to being more ubiquitous and helpful in developing nations. Because I know that that's been just the smartphone itself and people exchanging minutes in developing countries, cell phone minutes, just shows that this has become something that everyone can have a chance at having, even if you don't have some supercomputer.
Yeah, so the biggest uptake of mobile money is in Kenya, where about 70% of the adult population use a mobile phone to pay. We're actually not talking about smartphones. They're using even the old phones, and it's a similar system to SMS for making the payments. And so I think if someone cracks a way of interfacing between, and maybe they have done already, there's so much innovation in this space, but if someone has a way of interfacing your Bitcoin account with your phone and ability to pay with an SMS, then we will see it taken up a lot. I would prefer that such technological innovation is applied to other things, so things where the poor working together in associations where they agree how much to issue each other, they actually issue their own currencies to each other, credit currencies, where all the positive and negative balances add up to zero, rather than money itself being treated like a thing that we want and that we can hoard. And whether we can transact in our poor community depends on whether anyone's got some of this elusive money from, you know, some server that produced it in San Francisco. And if you believe that unsustainability is partly driven by the current monetary system, then whatever we can do to create alternatives, we should try it out.
Jem Bendel, thanks so much for joining me on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. It's great to be back on the show.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by The Meters, Mose Allison, and Ricky Lee Jones. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.